From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser. Every day we're bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance, plus technology, politics, so much going on in the world of politics, economics, and it's all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors. You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio. And be sure to watch us too on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.
A ton of virus headlines today. We had New Jersey's health commissioner saying she expects the state to get a COVID-19 vaccine in late December. We also had Roche being able to deliver its antibody treatments in the first quarter of 2021. We just talked about the strain on hospitals that we're seeing, the number of U.S. hospital beds occupied by COVID-19 patients rising this week to the highest since April. And if you look overseas, Canada, England, Austria, also seeing some stresses. It's been a rough day, a rough week when it comes to the virus. Joining us, as he always does every Friday, and grateful that he does, is Dr. Ian Lusbader. He is Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine at NYU Langone Medical Center. He is on the phone in New York City. Ian, good to have you back with us. How's it going?
Always a pleasure, Carol. Happy Friday.
Yeah, thank God.
Things are going okay. We're seeing a lot of regular patients and certainly a lot of COVID follow-up patients. The number of cases in New York so far is, or the number of hospitalizations, I should say, is not skyrocketing.
Yeah.
So I think based on antibody positivity, which is estimated about 20%, and kind of our rough go in March and April, although cases are up and hospitalizations are up, it's certainly not, thank goodness, overwhelming the system here. So I think the Midwest and out west is having definitely more of a challenge than we are, and we'll just have to see how we do with that.
What do you make, Dr. Lusbader, of kind of the rolling back? We're seeing it with New York City schools, sending kids back home to do virtual learning. We're starting to see rolling back in terms of the bars, but I still am surprised that things are even kind of open in that front. What makes sense to you? What doesn't? What needs to be done right now, in your view?
So I think part of that increased case positivity, which is really what they're basing, closing the schools on, may be incorrect or may be misleading. And I think every state has a different threshold. So it's not like there's a certain standard of when you need to think about doing these things and really how even effective they are. I think politicians sometimes feel they have to do something when really sometimes that thing is not really the best. We are doing a lot of testing. I'm seeing many of my patients are either visiting or potentially traveling or just curious. And so there are a large number of tests being ordered, either the swabs or the antigen tests. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing a lot of false positives. So initially someone may go for a nasal swab and antigen. We know no test is 100% accurate, and then they get a follow-up PCR test that's negative. So I think we have to be very careful with this positivity rate as a threshold. And I think the data about closing schools and certainly elementary schools really supports keeping them open for a variety of reasons, for the kids' education, for their mental health, for the parents' mental health. And so I think we are jumping the gun here incorrectly in closing schools. You could argue perhaps high schools where it does seem to be a little more communicable than the elementary schools. And I think the whole concept here of closing bars at 10 p.m. also is very, very confused. The virus doesn't say, oh, it's 9:59, I better go in. So, when you think about it, what we really want to do is discourage potential super spreader events like bars or gyms or where people are shouting, encourage people to sit outside. I think people can safely outside with heaters, eat and drink. And I think the schools should remain open unless there really is or an outbreak in that specific school of a higher number of cases. So I think it should really be individual.
What do you think about kids coming home from college for the holidays? Are you concerned? Because, you know, I'm sure you've been watching the numbers, and I know we report on it, but I feel like I want to know. It doesn't sound like we've had, you know, isolated cases of this school and that school, but for the most part, it seems like it's gone fairly well.
Yes. You know, I think it varies from school to school. There are schools, University of Michigan, where they really did have to restrict any in-person classes because it was rampaging through through the campus. Vanderbilt, under control, and that's not to point at one school or another. I mean, that could be based on a lot of factors. But those kids get tested on a weekly basis, and I think they have a much better handle on things. I do think, ideally, if kids can get tested in school before they come back, and if they're negative, I think that would be a lot more reassuring. We do anticipate a Thanksgiving bump based on traveling and kids coming back, families getting together. You know, there is a risk, and we know the cases are increasing, and they're probably going to go up a little bit more within a week or two after Thanksgiving, just based on people returning home.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's, you know, it's interesting. I've been watching kind of, you know, talking to different parents and what schools are doing. And I've been very lucky. My daughter's school, they kind of shut things down ahead of Thanksgiving and said, you're going to stay home for a week after Thanksgiving and you're going to have to take a test before you come back, you know, because we all understand there are going to be people who are unfortunately going to still kind of get together en masse. One thing I want to ask you, and then we'll do a break and come back, but I got about 45 seconds. The task force, the White House Coronavirus Task Force, meeting again, making some comments. What was the significance of that in your view? I mean, important to keep America up to date, but I just wonder what your takeaway was.
I think it is important to try to answer questions. I know there was a little bit of a hullabaloo about announcements. Overall, I think we have positive information with the vaccines. I think there are still some questions, remdesivir and other issues that have come up, as outlined in Bloomberg. We can talk about that on the second part.
Good.
But I think updating people is good, but you have to do follow-up questions.
So, Ian, what's up with remdesivir? I thought this was like a productive treatment.
Well, in medicine, they're often conflicting or confusing results, and depending on how you slice the data, you can sometimes get, you know, confusing results. And I think with remdesivir, we always knew that this was not the most potent antiviral. It was sort of the only tool in the toolkit, and typically it's used in a combination of hospitalized patients. So remdesivir was never really used for an outpatient. There is a new monoclonal antibody by Lilly that's coming out that's been approved that may be very effective sort of as a gap for outpatient use in a certain segment of patients. But remdesivir is always been used for inpatients, and typically it does show some benefit when combined with steroids and the sort of cocktail that patients have been getting when they come in, including some blood thinners. So this is really for people who are sick enough to be admitted. But certainly when looked at alone, you know, we know that it's not the strongest. And depending on when it's given, is it better early on, is it better later on, and so forth, I think there's conflicting data. And I'm not surprised that some studies, at least, show that it is not significantly effective. And I think it's going to be up to the individual hospitals to decide, is this worth the cost? In other words, there is a certain cost for the medication, and are the doctors seeing enough of a response to warrant it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's interesting. So what do you make, too, of everything that we've gotten? You know, you and I have talked already about Pfizer news. We got a little bit more Pfizer news about, you know, planning to apply for emergency use. Moderna also coming out. That is something that doesn't require the extreme refrigeration. I talked with the Moderna CEO, Stefan Bonsall, yesterday. So I don't know. How do you see it? We're making progress, right?
Absolutely. So on our segment several weeks ago, I had reported, that the preliminary data looked very good for both Pfizer, Moderna, the mRNA vaccines. The data showed very high antibody responses and T cell responses. AstraZeneca. So I think our listeners certainly are not surprised by this news, because we announced early on before it was released that there was certainly encouraging data. And so I think we're going to have several vaccines, all of which appear to be safe, all of which appear to be effective, not 100%. And again, there's individual risk, and until those vaccines are given out, and even after those vaccines are given out, it's not going to be 100%. And people who are still at risk, and we've talked about this, lung disease, diabetes, hypertension, obesity. People at risk still need to be careful until we develop enough herd immunity that there are really very few cases, and that may take a while. But I think we've definitely turned the corner. I think there's more good news coming with other vaccines. There's some good news about outpatient monoclonal antibody to spike protein. You know, all of this is expensive. This is not all going to be available for the Thanksgiving weekend. So people do need to be smart and careful. But I do think in the next few months we will see significant improvement. You know, unfortunately, we'll be up to, 300,000 deaths and hospitals being overwhelmed. So this has been a rough pandemic. It's not over. Yeah. There's definitely light at the end of the tunnel. So we have to be very careful until we're really able to, distribute all of this, which is still really several months away.
Well, and what's interesting, and I'm glad you said that, because we heard it from Anthony Fauci and the task force yesterday. I said I interviewed someone who is called Dr. Anthony Fauci of China, Dr. Wu Zunyo. He's the chief epidemiologist at the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Caught up with him. He too, many people are like, listen, guys, vaccine, it's not going to be here tomorrow. It's and especially when you think about mass distribution, and that in the meantime, it may not be the answer to everything. And that in the meantime, wear masks, social distancing, avoid those big gatherings. I mean, it really does come down to that. I know you and I have talked about it so many 100%. Times, but that's just quickly, that's what it's about.
We absolutely have to be self-aware and be careful until everyone gets the vaccine, and we have to encourage people to do that when it comes out.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer on Bloomberg Radio.
Yes, indeed. This is Bloomberg Business Week, the Friday edition. I'm Carol Messer, working from home on this Friday. Want to get into something. It was all over Bloomberg Radio today. We were talking about it too yesterday as well. And I'm considering it. It's a top story, no doubt about it. And it's about the battle between Mnuchin and Powell, or at least the apparent battle. We're talking about U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and also Chairman of the Fed, Jay Powell, of course. It's over the emergency lending programs and aid to help the economy. So let's get into it with Saleha Mohsin. She is a senior U.S. Treasury reporter at Bloomberg News. She's on the phone from Washington, D.C. So Saleha, lay it out for us. We kicked off our broadcast today. And our Vince Signorella said, it's not really a spat in that, Mnuchin has a point here. We could use this money to help out small businesses, other businesses. So what are you seeing?
Well, not only does Mnuchin have a point here, he is following the law, which we have seen on paper since March, that lawmakers agreed to. Every single senator voted in support of this, of the CARES Act in March. Every single senator should have read every single line of the act that they supported. And so it said, we will be sunsetting these facilities at the end of the year. Now, when the law was passed, it looked like this is just an 8-week problem. It didn't seem like this pandemic was going to go on for as long as it did.
Right.
But the spat kind of happens when it's the central bank itself issues minutes a unhappy message in response.
Well, so what are you hearing? Who's right? Is there a right or wrong here?
You know, I think it's also how you give information. Maybe if the secretary had prepared the landscape starting in September before Election Day, before all the polls were so set on who was going to win, who was going to lose, and said that everyone should just be aware that this is what the law says, and then we got to look at it and, you know, tick all of our boxes, then maybe this information, this message would have been received a little bit with less shock.
Yeah.
You know, that's a real big part of it. But markets have absorbed the message. Markets have recovered.
Yeah.
S&P 500 is relatively flat this morning after a lot of the news kind of came out. So,
well, and, you know, Saleh, you understand how this all works. I mean, is it the right of the Treasury Secretary to request this money back? And can he do it? Will it happen? Did it happen?
Well, see, yeah. Yeah, I don't know if it will. It should. He does have a right because Congress said that he needs to do this. He did point out that in March, when the $500 billion was being given to Treasury, the Democrats were saying that Mnuchin was going to abuse it as a slush fund for himself. And today, criticism is sort of bipartisan. All Democrats are unhappy that Mnuchin wants to return the money to Congress, and all Republicans are happy that he's doing it. I think this is also just a part and parcel that, you know, Congress just cannot agree to a stimulus, so maybe the secretary is trying to find a way to make that happen.
Right.
At the same time, you can understand the Fed is in a bind already. Their toolkit is, rates are historically low for a long time. They've expended a lot of energy on loosening the financial conditions. You don't know where we're headed next. So I can understand that this is a bit of a shock to people.
Well, and it's a reminder, Saleh, listen, you understand it. You follow the Treasury. You understand how the government works, right? And the Fed is about really kind of working with making it kind of easier for lending to happen within our economy. Congress is about spending money, right? And or giving money to Americans or to small businesses. And essentially, this money could go into another round of stimulus and help out, you know, some of those small businesses, the, you know, PPP money that we saw going out in that first wave of stimulus, virus stimulus.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we haven't seen another wave. You know, the Federal Reserve has been pleading for more fiscal stimulus. Yeah. You have very direct comments from Chair Powell and his colleagues that it is absolutely essential to have more. And it seems like Congress just has not really understood that message.
So what happens? Tell me what's expected. Here we are. We're just, you know, a little less than a week out from Thanksgiving. We've got, you know, Congress, you know, in terms of recesses coming up over the holidays. What are we anticipating in some kind of relief, you know, package, another round of relief? We know that Secretary of the Treasury, Mnuchin, he did kind of take some steps, right, to restart these stimulus talks. And he was talking with Democratic leaders about it.
Well, he hasn't spoken to them yet since elections about this.
Okay.
So today he spoke to Senator Mitch McConnell, who is supporting the idea that we should use the unspent CARES Act money that's already been appropriated and sort of siphoned off to spend to go ahead and find ways to use it for targeted relief in the economy. And so now they need to approach congressional leaders. Now, there's not very many vote days on the calendar between now and the end of the year. At the same time, you know, these facilities, they sunset at the end of this year, and it's just 15 or so trading days before the next administration is sworn in. So, you know, work can happen pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But each day that goes by, we know it's putting more pressure, especially if you watch those virus numbers, it's putting more pressure on businesses going forward. I mean, Saleha, is there some understanding that we will get something at some point, but the real sticking point now is just whether McConnell has repeatedly, I know you and Eric Wasson have done reporting, talked about, you know, $500 billion. We know the Democrats have talked about $1.4 trillion or even more. Can we expect that there will ultimately be something done? It's just a matter of how big and the timing.
We just can't bank on that. You
would
have thought this would have happened back in July or August. I mean, what is to say that they're going to do this during the lame duck period of the session? I mean, especially now that Republicans who have been so shy to do more spending are saying that, well, there's a vaccine now, so maybe we need to wait and see what more or if anything more is necessary. I really can't it's anyone's guess. It's a coin flip almost whether something is going to happen or not.
All right, Saleha Mohsin, you understand the Treasury Department. You understand Steven Mnuchin. You cover him. We've just got about 40 seconds left here. I mean, does he understand the difference between watching Wall Street and what that tells us about one thing about, you know, Wall Street is not the economy. Does he understand the distinction and understand the need for more aid? Just quickly.
I really do think so. He has been saying it vociferously since July that more fiscal relief is needed, and he does know that stock markets go up, they go down, but in the end, it's the economy that needs to be underpinning that market increase.
I think he might be working during the holidays. I'm just going to put it out there. Saleha, thank you so much. Love your reporting, and thank you so much for getting up to date on what really is a top story on this Friday. Saleha Mohsin, she is Senior U.S. Treasury Reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from the nation's capital.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
We talked about these stories this week. It's about how Joe Biden's election will undoubtedly come as a relief for international students. And then we also talked about keeping grandma safe as college kids head home for the holidays, covering it all for us, as she always does when it comes to colleges and universities. Bloomberg News higher education finance reporter Janet Lauren. She is on the phone in New York City. Janet, good to have you here. A great duo of stories. So let's talk about Joe Biden specifically. International students, they've got to be hopeful about a new administration come January.
Yes, that is true. They have seen a lot of discord in the Trump administration and proposals lobbed at them directly just this summer. We saw several that were concerning to them, including whether or not they would have to be deported if their universities pivoted online, which we actually did see very early on in August. And more, and of course, that was dropped after Harvard, MIT, and dozens of colleges and others sued. Another proposal was to limit their length of stay. There's been proposals about H-1B visas, hiring skilled workers from abroad. And now that the Trump administration will be ending in January, of course, there's a sigh of relief from universities who often depend on international students to pay the full price. But the question is, will they want to return, given the years of unwelcoming policies and rhetoric towards immigrants under the Trump administration? And we spoke to some MBA programs, and one was really stood out, the University of Toronto, which also had an increase in international students at the expense of probably some U.S. schools over the years. And I spoke to one student who is from Vietnam. She earned a college degree in the U.S. She earned a master's degree in the U.S. She went home to Vietnam, and when she was considering MBA programs, she didn't even bother applying to U.S. schools. She went to the University of Toronto. And as she said, Canada is a country that applauds international diversity. Compared to the U.S., Canada has become more and more welcoming. So given the idea that other countries, especially Canada, have been courting international students now for years, and that other universities within their home countries have gotten better over time, you know, it's not a slam dunk to have these international students return. And given the pandemic, where there's been a sharp drop in international students,
right?
You know, we will have to wait and see, but it could mean a lot of money to U.S. universities.
Well, it's interesting, and you include this in your story. According to a Bloomberg Businessweek Best B Schools analysis, this is something the Businessweek is really well known for, is their analysis and tracking of business schools around the globe. But their analysis of the magazine's top 20 U.S. schools, foreign students making up 29.5% of the class that began at elite schools in August or September, down from almost 35% 2 years ago. You know, it's interesting. I think about the broadcast that we did in honor of the Columbia Business School, one of the top-ranked schools, business schools, by Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. James Gorman, we caught up with, you know, from Australia. He's now a U.S. citizen, but talked about coming to the United States, coming to New York, what that was like. And then the conversations that he had, he said, with a very eclectic and international student body. So this is important to the schools, kind of their culture.
Yes. And of course, in addition to the revenue, they bring a diversity of ideas and thought. And employers love to hire international graduates from U.S. business programs because when they want to immediately put people around the world, it's not an issue for international students because they already have a lot of experience living abroad. So it's going to we'll have to see what happens, because there's other choices. Of course, with the pandemic, there's already been a sharp curtailing of international students. And, you know, we'll just have to wait and see.
All right. So Charlie and I had some fun with this yesterday, Janet. To be fair, Charlie playing Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. Grandma has enough problems around the holiday season, right, that they don't have to worry about or shouldn't have to worry about their college grandkids coming home and infecting them with COVID. You wrote about this.
Yes. In fact, the University of Arkansas's football coach even made a video telling students to mask up, get tested now, and protect your family and friends. Let's make sure we keep Grandma safe at Thanksgiving. And the University of Arkansas is one of a very handful of colleges that are actually allowing kids to come back after Thanksgiving. So the question is, what do you do? And there really is no great answer, because almost every itinerary raises a risk somewhere. If your student is flying home, that potentially could have a risk. We had a young lady at the University of Vermont who's coming home to New Jersey, but she's never driven that long by herself, so she enlisted somebody to drive with her. And, you know, where she's been in school at the University of Vermont, they've been doing testing every week, so her family felt comfortable with that. But, you know, it's just not a great situation.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, just quickly, 20 seconds. Do you think international students, what are you hearing? Are they going to be back in the fall, or it might take a while for them to warm up back to U.S. colleges and universities? Just quickly.
We'll be getting some application data in the next couple of months, and we'll have a better sense. But, of course, it's always also going to depend on any travel restrictions.
Yeah, all right. There's still that to think about. All right, Janet, always great to check in with you. A couple great stories. Check her out on Twitter at Janet Lauren. Of course, Janet Lauren, our higher education finance reporter at Bloomberg News, with us once again on the phone from New York City.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we're just about 12 minutes away from wrapping up the trading week. Stocks bouncing around. We took a leg lower. Now we're bouncing off our lows. We're still a little bit lower on this Friday session. Let's do the Drive to the Close. And great to have back with us once again is Aaron Kennan, co-founder, chief executive officer at Clear Harbor Asset Management, roughly $800 million in assets under management. He joins us once again on the phone from Stamford. Hi, Aaron. How's it going?
Great. Great to join you, Carol.
What's the week been like?
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you look at top line indices, not much has happened, but certainly we've seen massive news flow on the vaccine front, on the geopolitical front, on the economic front, and even the sector rotation that has occurred within the market has been somewhat significant, with most sectors that have been underperforming year to date really outperforming somewhat dramatically this week, and frankly even month to date. So it's certainly been an interesting week.
So like value and small caps?
Small caps, value, but at a sector level, for example, as you know, technology has been the great outperformer this year, along with consumer discretionary and communications. And on a month-to-date basis, energy, financials, industrials, all the laggards on the year have really had a massive move. Energy's up almost 18%. I think financials are up almost 13%.
Yeah.
Materials are up 10%. So we're starting to see some of that rotation. The broadening of the market is certainly somewhat welcome here.
I was just going to say, though, and it's also welcome in terms of if you're looking at it as a technician or from a fundamental perspective, that's what you want to see, right? The market widening out in terms of the gains.
That's right. I mean, I think that that's absolutely right, and we're seeing it. And the question is it sustainable?
Is it real?
Is it real? I think part of the lead to this broadening is the growth that we've seen in China, which is now a massive allocation to the emerging markets index. China tends to lead the global growth story. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the positive COVID news and it's just wonderful news on the health front, but also on the economic front. It gives us some window into when we should expect to see GDP growth accelerate again. And I think the distribution of that vaccine from Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and Moderna, I think you're going to have the CEO on shortly, the timing of that distribution, the size of the distribution over the course of any given week or month will be key to how consumers react to that and to the economy and how their consumption patterns evolve into 2021. So that's key.
So what's on the mind of the investors, your investors specifically? I know that there was a study of some institutional investors. I had another market guest on recently this week who did a call with money managers, and he said they were just so optimistic that it made me nervous. So I do wonder what you're hearing. Are people more cautious? Are people more optimistic? Do they feel like we have more visibility into 2021? What are you hearing? Is there kind of a theme there, Aaron?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the institutional side of the market is more bullish now than they have been in quite some time. I think Bank of America came out with a report earlier in the week that spoke to that. I would say at the high net worth level, at the individual and family level, there's still a lot of sort of disbelief that we sit here today and equity markets, both home and abroad, are for the most part up. Now, they've been led, of course, by the mega cap technology names, and so it has not been a broad-based rally. But nonetheless, the indices are higher on the year, and I think it's becoming a little bit of a show-me story. I would also say because this is an unprecedented year, in not only in that we have an election, but we have this sort of friction around the transition of power after the election. There's certainly some clients that are more concerned than perhaps the market seems to be about how that's going to play out.
All right. So it's interesting, too. I'm just looking at some of the stories that I was kind of reading in this morning. And one is from one investor who spent 14 years at the head of, let me just see, the OECD, forgive me, I just couldn't read it. He said, if you could see my desk right now at home, it's a mess. But he talked about the global economy could be facing a make or break moment in the COVID-19 pandemic as government's ability to cover the mounting costs nears its limits. We are safe to say, Aaron, at this interesting point where we've gotten some aid, but we're now in second, third waves globally when it comes to the virus. And I do feel like there is that disconnect between what you're seeing in Wall Street and then what you're seeing by many Americans, by many small businesses. And so I do wonder, you know, that make or break moment, will it be a good one ultimately, or will it be a bad one?
Well, that's a great question. I think in the short term, the stimulus will most likely continue. We'll debate about the timing of that, but we've seen the monetary side. The spigot's been open. We've increased our balance sheet at the Fed by $3.5 trillion this year. Mm-hmm. But to the point of that individual that you just referenced, certainly the long-term concern that we have here at Clear Harbor, that I have personally, is the degree to which debt-to-GDP levels, both at the public sector here in the United States and around the world, as well as even at the corporate level, are going to start to represent headwinds to long-term growth. And what will trend growth look like 10 years forward rather than 10 years past? And I think it's a real concern in the midst of this moment. Sure, we needed to spend capital, and we needed the Fed to put their foot on the gas pedal to overcome the COVID virus. But what are the long-term consequences to
right.
that?
Well, as someone who runs a business, right, you know, you're watching the markets, you're investing, you have clients, you have employees, you run a business. I mean, are you more on the cautious side and want to conserve capital at this point, you know, or are you thinking, okay, wait a minute, I'm starting to get a feel of what 2021 is like, and I can start to think about some of my strategic measures that I want to implement?
Right. I mean, I think you always need to have a plan and you need to have a process in any business, and you need to manage your growth.
But you know what I'm saying. Like, do you feel confident enough to say, you know what, we've been thinking about doing this. We were going to do it pre-COVID. We put it on hold. Now we're going to do it.
Right. You know, I do think 2021 is still a year in that regard of a question mark. Mm-hmm. The timing of the trajectory of growth, the degree to which the transition is a success, who wins the Georgia race, will this impact taxes and regulation? I have views on all these things, mm-hmm. but I think that there's a significant tail risk around, you know, some of these questions, and certainly I think they're impacting capital expenditures, and you're seeing that. You know, capital outlays have remained depressed, not just this month and due to the election, but frankly for a long time now.
Yeah, it's been kind of, I feel like, an old story, right? But it's just pretty amazing that in terms of capital expenditures, companies continue to rein it in. Hey, Aaron, thank you so much. Have a great, great weekend. Aaron Kennan, co-founder, chief executive officer at Clear Harbor Asset Management, roughly $800 million in assets under management, with us once again from Stamford, Connecticut.
Thanks so much for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or at Bloomberg.com. And be sure to check out our daily radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio. And be sure to watch us, too, on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.